There's a way, a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. And my guest today is Rachel Pritzker, who is a philanthropist who wants to take on wicked problems. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you.
And one of the reasons I invite you to the show, we've exchanged a number of conversations on Twitter, and you are a member of the board of directors for the Breakthrough Institute. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got involved with Breakthrough and what some of your primary objectives are these days?
Sure. I started out a more kind of straight up progressive funder, even living in D.C. So I was much more of a true believer Democrat, you might say, helping to create quote-unquote progressive infrastructure. So that would be things like media monitoring and think tanks that I thought would, or that a group of us really thought would help kind of make a better case about why progressive policy solutions were the right ones to enact and why those politicians were the right ones to elect. So I, over the course of a couple of years of really, you know, entrenching myself in the kind of sausage making of the political sphere, realized that we were just making the political discourse more partisan, and that I thought actually solving big problems wasn't something that was going to happen that way. If everyone is sort of forced to focus on the near term and our guys against your guys, then new ideas, long-term solutions, and actually big problems really never get addressed. So I took a big step back, and part of that was leaving D.C., and I moved to California, about as far away as I could get from the D.C. bubble. And I
There's always Hawaii.
Moved here right when. Yeah, exactly. Oh, maybe that's a little too far. So I moved here right when Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus were kind of forming the Breakthrough Institute, and I had met them in D.C. when they were doing some really cool social values polling, and were like consultants for a lot of the big green groups. And I saw a presentation on how they could sort of micro-segment and understand the electorate on a values level, which gave really interesting insights into like where the electorate was heading, what messages would really resonate with them, things that I didn't see anyone thinking that deeply about problem solving or the electorate when I was there. And I kind of watched their ideas go funk in the room because no one knew what to do with it. So I kind of like, you know, made a little mental note, oh, those guys are really deep thinkers, really doing interesting work. So when I moved out to California, I saw they were on their book tour for their book, The Breakthrough, and they had some really unconventional ideas about how to solve problems. And I thought, this is exactly the antidote to my hopelessness about the fact that nobody's thinking long-term and coming up with truly new solutions to big problems, because that was exactly what they were doing. I mean, I think their ultimate talent is to identify and question underlying assumptions. So I think they're not always popular, because I think it's really uncomfortable for people to have their underlying assumptions questioned. But I actually find it exciting and refreshing. And I ultimately found like it gave me my hope back, because I realized, okay, if we can strip some of these assumptions away, it allows us space for new ideas for how to solve problems. And I actually came away thinking, wow, this is a place I could have real impact on real problems that seems to me almost completely overlooked. So that was like 10 years ago. So while my work isn't only breakthrough, I would give Michael and Ted a lot of credit for helping me kind of develop a new view of how we solve problems. And I think together, along with their other sort of prime funder who now actually works at Breakthrough as well, Peter Teague, I would say the four of us have been on a journey together for the last 4 years of deep inquiry, along with a whole host of other thinkers and partners in this work, and have, I think we were almost 10 years in the wilderness of kind of questioning and picking apart assumptions. And just in the last year, I would say, we're starting to have some clarity about some of the answers to those questions, which feels like a new sort of stage of the work. Rather than saying, this traditional environmental approach isn't working, which is a necessary part of the process, we're now starting to say, and we think that something more along the lines of this might work. Not to say that we have all the answers, but we're starting to get some sort of fuzzy directional views of what we think might work better to solve both human needs and to also preserve a healthy environment. So that's really exciting stuff.
Oh, it sounds really exciting. It brings back memories to me of one of the most influential phrases I ever heard, and it was repeated to me on a number of occasions when I was in training in the nuclear submarine force, and that is, always have a questioning attitude. The follow-on to that was, one of the worst reasons for doing something is because it's always been done that way. The idea of going back and figuring out why you are doing a particular action, what's the basis for that action, and what your real goals are for the future is a very important part of the training that I had as a nuclear naval officer.
Yep. I would say that is applicable to so much of what I do. I mean, both just from the philanthropic perspective, if you look at the way most foundations and funders approach problems, there is so much already baked in, so many assumptions so deeply rooted and unquestioned about the nature of the problems we're facing and the, the range of solutions that are options, that I think it's incredibly hamstringing. And in a lot of cases, I think we could argue that the results are problematic. If you don't really understand the nature of the problem you're facing and you're not open to a wide enough range of solutions to actually achieve it, you can actually cause more trouble and in some cases stand in the way of solving the real problem.
Yes, and you can also, if you a priori shut off certain solutions because your tribe doesn't think those solutions are worth investigating, you can cause people outside to discredit anything you say. And what I'm talking about in this case, as a nuclear professional, I'm often a bit taken aback by how many of my colleagues automatically believe that climate change is some sort of liberal plot and don't agree that it's something worth addressing, even though they're specialist in a technology that has a real role to play in addressing that really wicked problem.
Yeah, certainly neither side holds the, I don't know. I mean, you see this behavior on both sides. I think it's partly it's human nature because it's easy and because we're tribal creatures and it is hard to question your assumptions. But I think it's particularly challenging for nuclear because you have the people who really understand the technology and are fans of the technology, like you say, often don't believe in climate, And frankly, that's really the best argument right now for it. And the people who really care about climate seem equally opposed to nuclear, which is really, in my view, one of the most promising ways to address climate. So it's in this weird, like, no man's land, which is, it's a big challenge.
Well, yes, it is. It's a huge challenge. And part, I've been struggling with trying to figure out how this works from a, although I'm a technical guy, I'm not really a technologist by initial training. I was an English major in college, so I really try to learn about humanity and what motivates people. And I really, for a long time, I wanted to write novels as a living. So the idea of trying to come up with motivation is something that's just part of my way of thinking. So I think that in some cases, because the nuclear industry has been so criticized for so many years by people, they have tended to react against that criticism and to classify anybody who's against them as somebody who's not in their tribe. And so when those people say something, they automatically disbelieve it. On the other hand, I guess people on the other side, and I by the way, hate putting human beings into one side or the other, because I think there are way too many facets in our society. There's a lot of sides. There's a lot of teams out there. You know, the liberals, you know, so many people have for so many years thought of the people who are pro-nuclear as being industry tools or weapons mongers or something. I don't know. And it's really...
Yeah, I actually think we need, like, new language and new advocates to talk about nuclear. You know, I think if we have, for one thing, people who care about the environment who would traditionally be seen as liberals talk about the reasons we need a wider tool set to address climate, would be really important. But I also think we need to expand the conversation beyond climate. I mean, I think there's a real moral case to be made for using a lot of energy to meet human development needs. You know, if you think about the, like, close to 2 billion people who don't have access to energy, who are going to get access to energy, wouldn't we prefer they get access to cleaner, safer, you know, forms of energy, and the kind that are that's really scalable. So, I just think there are a whole bunch of different ways we could be talking about this, and I think having different messengers would be really helpful, also. But you know, I go back to I like to think about how I became pro-nuclear because I was raised to be totally clear about it, my parents met on a commune. Like, I was raised a full extreme lefty hippie. You know, one of my earliest memories was actually grabbing onto the wrong bell-bottomed corduroy pants at an anti-nuclear protest and looking up and realizing that wasn't my mom. It was a different, you know, anti-nuclear protester. So I have, like, some street cred on the other side because I really do come out of that tradition.
You know,
I like to think about how I, you know, what it took for me to change my mind.
Yeah, I've got to break in and just
go ahead.
Respond a little bit to that story because I have a similar story of one of my daughters grabbing the wrong leg because she was surrounded by a bunch of khaki pants legs.
There you go.
Khakis, you know, when I was in uniform as a naval officer, she would reach up and grab the wrong one. So I just thought that's kind of amusing.
When you're that short and everyone's dressed the same.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's funny. So, okay, so part of the way I got into this was, like I said, through having my assumptions questioned about really getting real about the nature of the problem we're facing. So I think it first helps to give people a real sense of the challenge we're facing. So energy demand is really likely going to triple or quadruple over the next century, because people in the developing world are going to, they want to achieve modern lives. And I, you know, I think who are we to say they don't deserve equally high quality modern lives? And to meet that demand, you know, energy needs to rise. So if we really have a global view of energy, not just a U.S. view, there needs to be a lot more energy. So the numbers just don't add up for a lot of reasons with the current solution set that the environmentalist kind of worldview is sort of hanging everything on. We're just not able to, we're not scaling up renewable fast enough, and there are a whole bunch of reasons for that, but there are limits to how fast and how much you can scale up renewables that we're starting to figure out, that a lot of good research is going into, because we really need to understand how to do this. We need to understand how to do it quickly and cheaply, and there is a human, you know, development component to this that I think is often overlooked if we're focusing exclusively on climate. So my first, the first stage for me was to really go, oh, wow, this is actually a bigger problem than I realized. If we need to, you know, triple or quadruple energy output, we have to get serious about this. We can't be dabbling around the edges. So what's it going to take? Well, I, in addition to the Breakthrough Institute, I have a bunch of other, there's this whole ecosystem of thinkers and think tanks that are looking at the whole solution set. So I had a lot of conversations and a lot of really smart people doing research around me going through their own conversions around the same time a few years ago. And all of us were kind of going, you know, maybe we really should take a second look at nuclear. So we started digging into it and, you know, questioning all the assumptions about safety and about waste and about even about sort of what the challenges are around build-outs and price and all of that. And what we found really was different than what we expected. Even current nuclear technologies were far less scary and damaging than certainly I had assumed. I just had all these kind of assumptions baked in that really, when I went and looked at the numbers and looked at the, you know, statistics, just weren't true. I mean, one of the things that we had chatted about, I can't remember if it was through email or Twitter previously, was about this trip that I just went on in May to Fukushima. So it's a perfect example of, like, I actually, even though I've learned a lot and become much more comfortable with nuclear power, I expected touring the Fukushima site to be unsettling, to make me nervous, make me even go, ooh, you know, this technology is powerful. We need to be, you know, more careful about how we handled it, and there was something really bad that happened here. And yeah, something bad, really bad, did happen there, and it was an earthquake and a mega tsunami. And then, you know, an industrial accident. And then, honestly, I think the worst thing that happened after that was the handling of the situation. You know, touring the exclusion zone and the actual site with our own dosimeters, it basically dispelled a lot of my remaining fears, because, honestly, the background, the radiation levels there were really not that far from background radiation levels in all sorts of parts of the world that are known to be safe. So, you know, this has been a long process for me. And part of the process also was getting involved with the making of the film Pandora's Promise. So Robert Stone is a filmmaker who himself was a sort of true believer environmentalist, who had actually made anti-nuclear environmental films before, and realized that he thought nuclear power was going to have to be part of the solution. So he actually went around and interviewed all the people he could find, or actually he had to exclude a zillion people he found, but he interviewed a lot of people and then included a few of them in a film which tells the conversion stories of prominent environmentalists and thinkers who had basically changed their mind about nuclear power and how and why they had done that. So, in fact, being a part of that film was also a part of my conversion story, kind of ironically. And it was a good education as well. So yeah, I just think, information really helps.
Yeah, as an advocate for nuclear energy, I sometimes feel jealous of those who can tell a conversion story, because I don't have a conversion story. My dad came home from work one day when I was 8 years old and said, "You know, we're building these new power plants that don't even need smokestacks." And ever since then, I've been fascinated by nuclear technology, and of course as I tell people, there aren't very many people who can say they've hugged a reactor before, but I have. it wasn't actually operating at the time I hugged it, but I was in charge and have lived for many months within 200 feet of an operating reactor. And it was one of my favorite shipmates because it provided our ship with all the power we needed to move around the ocean, plus heating, ventilation, air conditioning, power for our computers and television sets, our refrigerators and freezers, and even to make our own fresh water and fresh air. So,
right. That's actually a good way to it hints at the fact that energy basically is this unseen force that does everything that we need. and in some ways it can substitute for other things, like providing fresh water, heating and cooling, like all these things that otherwise would take other natural resources can be substituted for by additional energy use. So if we have a truly clean, truly safe, and ideally cheap source of energy, actually using energy is a good thing. You know, in fact, using more energy can help us reduce our uses of all sorts of other natural resources, like forests don't have to be chopped down if people get access to energy and don't have to burn firewood to heat water. Mm-hmm. And, we can desalinate ocean water. We can, fully incinerate trash down to the molecular level. And, there are all sorts of amazing things that power could do if we really scale up cheaper, cleaner, safer forms of it.
Well,
so you use a kind of flip of paradigm.
You use an important word there when you shifted from energy to power, because from an engineering point of view, power is simply energy per unit time, and so you sometimes need to use energy quickly in order to have the power to do things. And when you empower people, they can suddenly do a lot more work to make their world a better place.
Yeah. It substitutes for human labor in all kinds of ways, too. I mean, if you think about the life that people without energy lead, the amount of demanding physical labor that entire families, just to haul water and scrounge for firewood, and like, life is really, really hard without energy.
Yes. And,
and without power, it's like,
One of the books that unfortunately has been long out of print was published early on after the beginning of the atomic age, and it was a book about the wonders that the atomic age were going to bring us, including the ability to cross the oceans using mere buckets full of fuel. But one of the chapters in that book went through the calculations of how much power a human being can produce over time. And the end result of the calculation was that the average American, because they have access to commercial supplies of energy, has the equivalent at that time in the late 1940s of about 63 human beings, and the word used in that book was energy slaves. To imagine, you know, how we live today compared to eras where there wasn't commercial source of energy, and so there were people who lived very well, but they owned or controlled other human beings to do their to make them live well.
And this idea
of harnessing energy to do that is an amazing part of, quite frankly, being an American or a modern in living in a modern society.
I like the idea
of harnessing energy slaves. I'm kind of, you know, aghast at the idea of human slaves.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of way to describe it, because it does, if you look at people trapped in the kind of wood economy who don't have access to energy, it really does look like slavery. I mean, they're like beasts of burden, and I wouldn't wish that on anyone. So, you know, the idea that we're going to withhold energy from people because we quote unquote can't afford, you know, the emissions, boy, that is, I don't think people realize those are the choices they're making. But we do have in our conversations about global development and energy access, there is a lot of focus on helping people basically be more comfortable in poverty and giving them like an hour of light a day and maybe, you know, an hour or two of a fan a day. But that's not liberation from drudgery, but and it doesn't give them really a path out of a developmental path out of poverty. It doesn't give them access to a full modern life, which is really what I think we should aspire to. And if we aspire to that for everyone, then we really got to figure out a realistic way to fully power the planet. And I think one additional benefit of nuclear is, you mentioned this just sort of in passing, is the energy density issue. So, you know, the idea that you could power that ship with just a small amount of fuel is a really big deal. If we're going to have increasing amounts of global energy demand, then finding a way to do that without using a lot of space, without using a lot of land, without a lot of fuel inputs and waste outputs, is really important, and there is really nothing more energy dense than nuclear.
You know, I didn't put any real numbers on that, but I'd like to right now. That reactor that powered my submarine was using 1970s vintage technology. Actually, the submarine was a 1960s submarine, but it had been refueled. So the core was installed in 1981. And powered that 9,000-ton submarine around the ocean until it was decommissioned in 1995, so 14 years. The amount of uranium in that core was just slightly more than what I weigh. Okay, powered a 9,000-ton submarine, and that the residue from that operation for 14 years would fit underneath my office desk.
Yeah. No, I like how you call it residue, because now, you know, in fact, with some of the newer technologies, you know, what comes out at the end of a you know, the current light water fleet, which we're now calling, you know, waste, could actually be starting fuel for some other more, you know, newer versions of these nuclear technologies that are on the cusp of scaling up, which I think actually makes it look kind of like a renewable resource.
Well, if you, according to the Energy Information Agency, when you burn waste to energy, as in an incinerator, that has, mm-hmm. at least up until a few years ago, counted as a renewable resource in their statistics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you mentioned, current light water reactors, the fuel has about 95% of its potential energy still remaining in the fuel, and could be reused. Transatomic power and TerraPower and a number of other companies are really looking hard at that as a resource, not as a waste. I like to call it reusable
fuel.
That's
actually an area that I've gotten really involved in, because I think it offers another interesting way to kind of break through this stagnant conversation about nuclear energy, because this range of advanced nuclear technologies really fundamentally address most of the concerns that anti-nuclear people have. So, you know, first of all, it's a whole category that, as you know, has a lot of variation in it. But the category of there's basically a renaissance in nuclear technologies happening. Third Way, one of the think tanks I work with, recently did a survey and found that there are 50, that's 50, companies just in North America alone in this space. And they're in varying states of readiness. Some, you know, have just spun out of a university lab. Some are like VC funded and like pretty far down the path of design and testing. And I think the Department of Energy and even I think actually everyone, even some of the players in this field, were really surprised to hear that there was $1 billion of private investment and 50 companies in this space that really no one knew existed. So that, to me, is really, really exciting, because a whole new category of technologies that really offer like a breakthrough in terms of all the impediments to this sort of quick scaling, as well as public perception issues around previous nuclear, to me is really exciting. To have something new to say about these technologies has also really opened up a lot of conversations with people that otherwise would have been unable to talk about nuclear. So far, our experience having these conversations in Washington, for example, with policymakers has been that there doesn't seem to be any partisan kind of opposition, or there's not even a partisan nature to the conversation about advanced nuclear technologies. You know, it's like it opens up a space that didn't exist, because if you can say these are technologies that are fundamentally different from the ones we had all these battles over. And really what they need is a licensing pathway and probably access to a national lab test facility where they can, you know, take their experiments to the next level. And this is a national security issue, but this is also a national leadership issue and a real opportunity, because frankly, if we don't provide them a pathway in this country within the next year or two, they're all going to go to China or Russia. And people on both sides of the aisle perk up when you say something like, look, this is U.S. technology that could like help power the world, help reduce the cost of energy, help, you know, reduce emissions, provides all these really exciting potential benefits. And they're coming out of our entrepreneurs. And we're not asking, you know, a whole lot for you to clear a licensing pathway for them. And it turns out that this so far is something that there isn't a whole lot of partisan opposition to it, which, you know, fingers crossed that continues to be the case. But it's something I haven't seen in D.C. before.
I love that phrase, clearing a licensing pathway, because so mm-hmm. many of the things that stop the conversations I've had about advanced atomic technologies over the last 20 years end with, well, the NRC will never give you permission to do that, and the conversation stops.
Right.
And that I have to keep reminding people that whatever opposition, whatever obstacles have been placed in the path of advanced nuclear technologies have been placed by people, which means that people can get together and start tearing down those barriers and clearing the pathway again. And I also love the idea of using some of the national assets that we have at places like Idaho National Labs or Savannah River Site to provide a space, you know, a safe space with plenty of security and infrastructure where people can really test their ideas.
Yeah, and the knowledge of how to, you know, handle these fuels and, I mean, you could embed NRC regulators there to learn right along with entrepreneurs. I think, you know, I think there's a lot of promise. And the national labs have been given a mandate to figure out how to partner better with the private sector and how to do work that's really going to be useful and lead to a spin out of successful companies. So this is a perfect example of something that could really lead to that. And I think, you know, the idea that like how some kind of process is now is immutable kind of makes sense if you're coming at it like, you know, you're a nuclear engineer and you have a great idea. And that's because you've never interacted with the federal government. You see it as this monolith. But it's actually just, like you said, it's people, and they made choices. And if they actually understand the nature of the opportunity, the nature of the technology, and the right people engage with them to help them understand what these technologies and what these companies need, it's not a fixed situation. These are all changeable. So a lot of smart people are now working to figure this out. And actually the NRC is now really interested in helping to figure this out, as is the Department of Energy, as are stakeholders in both the House and the Senate. So I think just in the last year we've seen basically nobody knew this was a category like a year ago. And now this year there have been like committee hearings, you know, there were congressional hearings in December and July focused on this issue, highlighting the need for an improved regulatory process and a pathway. And then really also very exciting, there's a joint NRC-DOE workshop on what to do and how to kind of help accelerate these advanced reactor designs September 1st and 2nd.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of a sudden it's really caught the imagination of all the people that matter. And, you know, Idaho had recently also a gathering about innovation in the nuclear sector. And I think it makes sense. Like, every other area has had innovation. I mean, it's sort of a overused word. But truly, you know, technological improvements are happening everywhere. And why not in an area where there is just so much opportunity for improvement and where very little has happened in a very long time?
Yeah, I like to.
So I'm excited to see it.
Yeah, I like to remind people that the very basic physics of being able to split uranium or thorium or plutonium and release energy was only discovered when my mother was 6 years old. And my mother's still alive.
Yeah.
And so that indicates how short a period of time we've even known that fission was possible. Again, the very basic physical phenomena of splitting atoms was 1939, or 38, well, late 38, explained in early 39. So that's not that long ago. And it used to drive me a little bit crazy to have people tell me, well, nuclear is so yesteryear technology. It's obsolete.
That's just wild, yeah. Oh, and I, you know, and then you compare it to any other technology, like, you know. So what energy technology is more modern? I mean, I recently saw a New York Times headline from the 1880s that said, "Solar is about to be profitable." Right? Like, you know, so which of these technologies is more modern? I don't know. If you imagine, like, which, you know, which sci-fi starships are powered on, I don't know, wood or hydro or any
wind.
It's always something more like
dilithium crystals.
Yeah, I mean, it always is, because it's the most modern. It's like futuristic, and it's dense, and it just, so yeah, the idea that it's old, you know, your daddy's kind of technology, it's just so, I think part of it is that the word gets associated with nuclear weapons, and so somehow in people's minds, it's stuck in the era of when we were exploding bombs, when we were doing testing, and when we were dropping bombs on Japan. I think somehow the N-word, like, it gets conflated with weapons, and then people, they either have it as, like, a 1950s kind of thing, or they have it as a Cold War thing in their heads, but it's always, like, in the past, and it's always associated with weapons. And I think, I'm not sure what you do about that. I don't know if we actually need, like, to start using different words.
Well, this is the Atomic Show,
really,
by
unfortunate.
The way.
This
is the Atomic Show, and which it was published by Atomic Insights, and the the initial impetus for Atomic Insights was as a part of the Adams Atomic Engine Company.
Yeah, that's great.
So I started moving away from nuclear a long time ago.
Yeah, well, I think you're onto something, because that the word still just inherently gives people willies. And I think, you know, one good example of that is that the MRI machine and sort of MRI testing didn't really take off until they took the word nuclear out of the name.
Right. Well, you know, people tell me, well, atomic is just as bad. I said, no, because people buy atomic fireballs. They ski on atomic skis. So atomic must be an okay term.
Yeah.
And the atomic age was an age of hope and prosperity and real vision for the future. You bring up the an interesting time. One of the things I've been I guess maybe irritating some of my Atomic Insights readers with is I've been spending a lot of time digging into the history of what caused people to be afraid of radiation. And one of the things I found was that through the 1940s and early 1950s, people were very optimistic about what the atomic age was going to bring them. And if you do searches in the New York Times, you find a lot of articles that talk about the wonders of the atomic age. And as you say, sometime around the mid to late 1950s, you started to find the word fallout being used very regularly. And there was a lot of controversy about the fallout from nuclear weapons testing. And there was a report that was released by the National Academy of Sciences on June 12th of 1956, that resulted in headline articles in the New York Times that talked about the peril to mankind of atomic radiation. And one of the reports says that all radiation is bad, no matter how small the dose. And
I believe that report
had a very important influence, and it was the establishment of what I refer to as the no safe dose assertion. Interesting thing that I've been finding, and there are other people that have been doing a lot of research in this area, including Ed Calabrese, a toxicologist from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, is that all of that work that established this no safe dose assertion was funded by a single philanthropic organization.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, it is amazing how much power funders have. So, for example, there are a lot of people within a lot of the top environmental groups, which are really the main sort of source of opposition to nuclear energy, who will admit privately that they're pro-nuclear, but will say basically that they don't feel like they can do anything about it because they would lose their funding. So I really think that we need to have a bigger conversation in philanthropy about really what the goals are. Like, are the goals to scale up renewables? Should the goal instead be to meet global energy demand while lowering emissions? Like, you know, if you really get serious about the goals and separate them out from the means, I think it's time to really have some new conversations also in the funding community. So I'm doing my best to have those conversations, but I think it's going to be just a process. I think another thing that is often misunderstood in the funding community is that this is a global problem. I see so much, and to be clear, I think, you know, the climate funding community is well-meaning. So I don't want to disparage anyone's motives, but I think if people really think deeper about the fact that this is truly a global problem, for one thing, focusing on efficiency, seems really like a distraction. It's like us, you know, because us eating slightly less here is somehow going to help somebody starving in China has never made sense to me. So
right.
It's the
they're
real
already
problem.
Not, they don't have a light to turn on, so how can a more
right.
efficient light bulb help them?
Right, and us using slightly less here is going to really be negligible when you consider, you know, almost 2 billion people who are going to get access to energy whether we like it or not.
You know,
so
that,
anyway, yeah,
that philosophy sounds a little bit...
I think there's a lot to do. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that philosophy reminds me of the 1950s, 60s vintage saying from parents, you need to finish your food because somebody's starving in China.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it never made sense to me as a kid even. I was like, well, what are you going to do, send it to them? Like, it doesn't help. So, yeah, so I think there are a lot of distractions. I think thinking of this as a U.S. problem that we can, like, regulate our way out of, you know, even if we were willing to pay marginally more for energy here, again, I don't think in the developing world they're not able to pay more, for one thing. But really they shouldn't. You know, that would just prevent more people from getting access. So I think paying more for current technologies is not the solution either. I think truly investing in bringing down the cost of scalable baseload power like advanced nuclear is really the way out of this. I don't really see how we can get there without it.
So, Rachel, as a member of the funding community and as a member of a family of funders, can you help me understand why organizations like the NRDC and the Union of Concerned Scientists and Sierra Club are afraid they would lose funding if they came out in favor of nuclear or at least even thinking about nuclear as a tool?
Yeah. So those organizations have a set of funders who are, of course, a very mixed, you know, group. So there's going to be a wide range of perspectives and beliefs and experience. But I think you'd find that a significant percentage of them haven't re-examined their thoughts about nuclear energy and are still really fearful of it. And I think they also assume that it's unnecessary. I mean, I don't think they realize the nature of the problem. And I think they've been sold a bill of goods which says if we get better at efficiency, so, you know, we use less, and we continue to scale up wind and solar, we don't need anything else, and we can solve this problem. And I think that is really, you know, there's a lot of evidence to support the idea that that's a risky gamble. For one thing, it's never been done. For another thing, for all the time and energy and money we've dumped into that pathway, wind and solar are still only powering, you know, maybe 2% of the world's energy is coming from renewable resources. Now, I mean, I think it's a tricky thing because they often dump a lot of other technologies in when they say renewables. So the category is often includes things like hydro, which is totally different for a whole bunch of reasons. It often includes all kinds of bioenergy. Sometimes they even throw nuclear in there. Like, it's very... So I think people get confused about what's possible. And then again, I think they forget this is a global problem, and they focus on, like, well, all we need to do is pass legislation to put a price on carbon, and then the markets will just solve this. And I think, you know, for people who understand politics, it's very clear that you can't actually, anywhere in the world, you can't pass a legislation of any form, whether it's a cap and trade or a price on carbon, and, you know, a gas tax or whatever, that's going to have any significant impact on reducing emissions, because that would raise energy prices. So you'd have to pass something low enough to not raise energy prices, which would not then, you know, therefore not reduce emissions. So I think that's the other confusion that the funders have. But if they're in a bubble where everyone is assuming all these things together, they're never exposed to another perspective, and that's part of the problem. If you work in these fields, like, you know, your social life, your professional life, your entire world and your tribe all have bought into all these assumptions, and you are very disincentivized to question it. Whether you're a funder or a professional advising them or somebody running these organizations, it is hard to question those assumptions because you're risking your entire livelihood and you know, community and the good standing of your colleagues. So it is not easy. I give people a lot of credit who are able to do it. And I have a lot of sympathy for those who are kind of stuck in it going, ooh, I'm not sure this is right.
Well, I guess my advantage is I've always been a loner and an antisocial son of a gun, so I don't care if people like me or not. But, you know,
I'll tell you, I got invited to a lot less parties when I first kind of left D.C. and had that, like, questioning of what, you know, what the role of political philanthropy could be. And it was hard. But ultimately, I ended up finding there is this whole other community of people who are questioning assumptions, where having the tough conversations is welcome. And I got to say, their parties are better.
Yeah, I really am still regretting the fact I didn't make it out to the Breakthrough Institute's meeting in June. Unfortunately,
yeah, that's a good one.
Unfortunately, Michael and Ted lost out to Ian. Ian is my brand new grandson. So.
Oh well, congratulations! Yeah, so. Family takes precedence. I think so. Good choice.
But you know, some gatherings like that will be fun, and I intend to participate in future gatherings.
Yeah.
That's great. I hope that that I can bring a different perspective, because again, I'm not a convert. I haven't spent a lot of time unlearning things, The nuclear navy taught me a long time ago that small amounts of radiation are nothing to worry about, but you do need to monitor and keep it under control. Make sure you don't get too much, because too much radiation is certainly bad for you. But small amounts are not a problem.
Along those lines about like face and how you describe radiation exposure, Richard Muller at Berkeley wrote Energy for Future Presidents. Had a great idea for how to describe radiation doses, because I think part of the problem is when people say, you know, this much millisieverts or microsieverts or, the descriptions mean nothing to people. When they hear the radiation level is this or that, even the media reporting it has no idea what any of that means. So his suggestion was, instead, we should just refer to it as in a unit that we call the Denver dose. So like it's two times the Denver dose, or it's a quarter of the Denver dose. And the Denver dose would be the amount you get exposed to living in Denver, where natural background radiation, because of the granite rock and the altitude, for whatever reason, is much higher than most places, but they happen to have a lower cancer rate than most places. And so that would be a really handy baked-in way to contextualize the dose.
Yes, I agree with you, although in part of me simply says we simply need to agree on what the units are, and we'll learn how to discuss the units just like we learn how to discuss how much a dollar is and how much a pound is. But when it comes right down to it, this paper that I mentioned that was released in June of 1956 made it very clear to people. The conclusion of the paper was, it doesn't matter how small it is, they're all bad. And that paper was produced by a very credible organization and given a tremendous amount of publicity, which as a guy who's been trying to get people's attention for many years, I recognize publicity doesn't come for free. It doesn't come by accident. I'm quite certain that the people that were behind this particular report established a communications plan and had press releases ready to go. In this particular case, the board of directors or board of trustees of the foundation included Arthur Sulzberger, who was the publisher of the New York Times, which probably made it a little bit easier for them to get good publicity. And by the way,
Do
you know who the mysterious foundation is I'm talking about?
I don't.
It was the Rockefeller Foundation. They not only produced the report or produced all the funding for the National Academy of Sciences to produce its report, but they'd been funding the people who produced the report, the Genetics Committee. Most of the people in that committee had been receiving Rockefeller Foundation grants for their entire scientific careers.
Yeah, and you know, I gotta say, having worked in this field and knowing some of those players, I don't fall into the kind of conspiracy theory of like foundations are you know trying to mess up the world or whatever people think. I truly believe that people running these organizations believe they're doing something helpful. And I think in this case, they probably deeply believed that radiation was dangerous and, thought that they were doing something that was going to help people by letting everyone know how dangerous it was. You know, the fact that I think, you know, we both really can see that there was a downside to that probably never occurred to them. But this is kind of the danger of the power of foundations and funders. If they don't look deeper and think deeper about the consequences of their funding and even think deeper about the nature of the problems they're trying to solve, there can be really, really problematic unintended consequences. So I think it's a perfect example.
Well, I will allow that there are many ways to interpret the information. And you do know more people in the funding community than I do. However, I've also read the biographies of John D. Rockefeller and David Rockefeller, and recognized that they were people who recognized very clearly exactly what the power of money was and how to make money by ensuring that they had control over the supply of energy. John Rockefeller, one of his primary innovations in the oil business was not in finding oil. He was not, in fact, an oil producer. He recognized that the money to be made was in controlling access to the oil, controlling access to the markets, and controlling transportation to make sure that you didn't oversupply the market. Because as we've noticed in the last year,
I don't know anything about the motivations there, but
What I was going to say is, as people have noticed or should have noticed in the last year, if you have just a little bit more oil than the world wants, the prices fall dramatically. The price of oil has dropped from over $100 a barrel, and now I think it's toying with about $45 a barrel. So those companies that sell oil have got to be making a lot less money now than they were a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not conspiratorial. That's simply business. When you're selling a product, a commodity product, and you can produce a certain amount, every dollar of increase in the price goes to your bottom line, and every dollar of decrease in the price falls off of your bottom line. Because your costs are pretty fixed. So, again, it's not conspiratorial. But anyway, so Rachel, what are you doing? What other things are you doing to encourage innovation? I see something called the Pritzker Innovation Fund.
Mm-hmm.
What's that all about?
Yeah, so that's the foundation. Yeah, that's the foundation that my brother Roland and I run. And it's kind of what we use to do that's the vehicle we use to do the work that we do in this space. So we fund a variety of thinkers and think tanks, and we help organize convenings. One of the things that we're really proud of is our involvement in this document that was recently published called the Eco-Modernist Manifesto, it's basically the product of a year-long process and conversation with a group of 18 thinkers from a range of disciplines, from conservation biologists to climate scientists to political scientists to really all kinds of smart and interesting people who wanted to paint a vision of how, basically an alternate vision to environmentalism, of how we can meet both human needs and preserve a healthy environment. And it's really a hopeful document that paints the vision of how we can, in a range of areas, solve some of these big challenges, and most of it through the smart application of technology. So, essentially, instead of shrinking from technology and trying to go back to a time in the past before some of the unintended consequences of our current technologies scared us, rather, improving upon the technologies and adding new and better ones. And actually, things like clean, cheap energy can help solve a lot of these problems, but also, processes that are already happening that could be accelerated, like urbanization, also can help preserve wild places and speed up human development. So that document and sort of that conversation, which the document really just started the conversation. There's now a website, it's ecomodernism.org, where many people are responding now, and there's become sort of an ongoing conversation about it, because the document really was meant to just be the beginning of a conversation. It's very high level with none of the details essentially fleshed out because we feel like it's going to be a process, and we're eager to include lots of other perspectives and expertise in helping flesh out a vision of how it actually works. So that's been really exciting and certainly something that's taken our focus. And like I said, the advanced nuclear licensing pathway work has been a huge piece of what we've been focusing on as well. So those are two big pieces.
Well, that's great. And I'm so pleased to find that there are people like you, funders, who are excited about engaging in really solving problems and in doing the math and recognizing that some things may help, but they certainly can't do it by themselves. And recognizing that we do have a tremendous asset here in America in our questioning, our innovative thinkers, and in our individualistic, hey, give me a chance and let me go forward, mindset. I think that we really can provide some innovations that can make life better for people around the world. One of the things you mentioned that again kind of always irritated me a little bit was when people opined about how great things were in the past. I know a little bit about my own family history, and I know that my father grew up on a farm in southern Georgia where if they saw $300 a year in cash, it was a good year, and where they didn't have electricity. I don't want to go back to the past. My family was one of the ones that didn't have anything in the past, so I'm not interested in going back there. I didn't want to live that way, and I was happy that I was able to grow up in a house with plenty of electricity, and we had campers, and my relatives had power boats and things that were fun to use, but they used a little bit of fuel. That's just the way it goes. But they do make life a little better. So
I agree with you. I think there is a lot to appreciate about how good the present is compared to the past, and I think if we are smart about it, the future can be even better than the present.
Yeah, the one part of the past that I would like to go back to is those days when people were excited about individual airplanes. On the small suburban block I grew up on, I had four people on the block that had their own plane, and we were not a wealthy neighborhood by any stretch. It just was, airplanes were cheap back then, and we had a local airport about four blocks away. It was a different time. At that time, the Jetsons, people really believed that we were going to all have our own airplanes.
That would be cool.
I thought it was great, but most of those.
Well, soon it'll be like self-driving cars, right?
Well, as I'm getting older, I'm recognizing the utility of self-driving cars. About the time I'll really need one, maybe they'll be available. Because I see some of my relatives who America's a great place to move around as long as you've got your own personal vehicle. Or if you live in a city, not many of us, I've never lived in a city, so I'm kind of a suburbanite by habit. And when you get older to the point where you start not being able to drive at night, or when you start recognizing, and the honest people recognize that they're not really as sharp as they used to be and probably shouldn't be out on the road too much, that's when I really think self-driving cars would be a huge boon. Again, I grew up in South Florida. I can tell you that many of the Q-tips, that we used to see riding around, Q-tips were the little ladies who just see a little bit of white hair and as they're driving their cars. Self-driving cars is a great idea for them. They get their keep their freedom and make everybody a little safer.
Yeah, that's funny. I've heard a lot of conversation because I live in San Francisco, so I hear lots of conversation about self-driving cars. But it's funny here because it's all like 20-something tech guys talking about it. I never heard them raise the idea of the, well, and the importance of the market of people who are, you know, old enough that it's not safe for them to drive anymore. And that is a really great point.
Well, they need to go. They need to go to a retirement area and see, you know, what the market could be. And again, I grew up in South Florida. It's a tremendous potential because our country is built on automobiles moving around, and people in San Francisco live in a bubble, as you mentioned before.
Yep.
That, you know, the
for sure
that environment is exciting. But it's a bubble compared to the rest
bubble.
Of the country.
Oh, yeah.
And there's,
absolutely.
I think, if I remember the number correctly, there's something like 150 million automobiles in the U.S. And, you know, there's many places in the country that are great places to live, but if you don't have a car, you can't really get around at all because there's not much in the way of taxi service. And, everything you need to get into a car to get to, you know, as you get older, you really can't walk a couple of miles to the grocery store. So, you know, there's a market for self-driving cars and a market for having a society that has plenty of energy to make sure that those cars can be supported and fueled and everything else. So, so thanks for your time, Rachel. I'm fascinated by this conversation. I hope we continue to stay in touch, and I'm excited to hear. Are you going to be at that meeting at the NRC?
Yeah.
Oh, well,
absolutely.
Good. We'll be able to meet face to face then. I think I was one of the.
Well,
I think I was one of the first ones to register.
In a couple weeks.
Yeah. Great. And you'll be back in D.C., one of your favorite places.
Yes. I do like to visit D.C.
Well, I worked in D.C.
Thank you.
I worked in D.C. for 9 years. I love to visit it.
Exactly.
It's a fun place, but not necessarily the place I want to work anymore. All right. Take care.
Good. Well, thank you again. This was a fun conversation.
Thanks, Rachel. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye, Rod.
There's a way, such a better way. Today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.